Hey, good morning.
Good afternoon.
Good evening.
Good night.
And a fresh bowl of strawberries. That's what we're doing today?
Yeah.
How you doing, man? You doing good with the old healthy eating?
I don't want to talk about it.
Why are you saying that? Are people discouraging you these days?
I hate talking about food and diet with people. Everybody got their own opinion.
But then why do we make it?
You're losing weight. I noticed weight loss. Very good.
I never know what to say to that. Do I say thanks?
Very good.
Yes. Thank you.
You're supposed to say thanks.
Why, though? Why thanks?
Because it's a good thing.
It's good to lose weight.
You're losing weight. Yes. Fact.
It's a great thing.
No, it's also a yes. It's a thank you. Hold on.
But you don't know if what if I wasn't doing it on purpose? Thank you. It would be hurtful, maybe.
If you had Ebola.
Yeah. I don't know. I say when people say you're losing weight, I say
yes, I am.
That is a fact.
Well, no, but here's the problem, Saif. First of all, we're going to introduce our amazing guests.
It's not like if you say, oh, you're looking good. Now I'm like, oh, thanks.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? You're losing weight.
Right. Well, what about this? What about this? Why is it a common thing that, and this only happens to guys, I think, but it still can make you feel bad if you're someone who struggles with your weight a little bit, when guys come up to you and do something, and I've seen it happen to you, so I already know, pat you on the stomach.
Oh, yeah. Well,
like, yo, you doing good. I see you eating.
What is that?
I don't know what to, yes, you saying I'm fat, and then sometimes it's like, you don't understand, I might have just lost 20 pounds.
Right, right, right. But they haven't seen you.
But you haven't seen me in 10 years, and you're like, damn, you're living good. You fat.
So you're fatter than when you were when you knew them.
Right.
But you're less than where you were a couple months ago.
My dad has a story about my parents' best friend, Ken, who's like he's like my uncle. He's like family. Ken has gained a lot of weight since he was 17. Keep in mind, he's 65. Mm. He ran into someone, and he had just lost like 75 pounds. And they hadn't seen him since high school. And the first thing they said was, oh, my God, you got so fat.
Damn, you got big.
He's like, I just lost 75 pounds. Yeah, so, yeah, I don't understand why guys like to mention
it's a good thing. It's a good thing and it's a bad thing and it's a good thing. Like for example, like if you see somebody, let's say somebody in the industry that got successful, they get successful because they're eating now. They're making money, you know. They eat more.
No, I see the – but if
like,
some
– So you get that pat on the belly like, yo – I see you eating, you're doing your thing.
See, but to me, the problem is I get that mentality, but that would be it would make more sense for someone who like came from nothing, right? I'm from the suburbs, so it's like I always had a good meal in front of me. It just means I'm a fat fuck. It's a different kind of compliment.
Or if you got married and then you got fat. You got that,
right.
Yo, I see
I had that
eating,
too.
You got that married belly.
Exactly. I don't want anyone to just for future reference to all people in the industry, don't pat my belly. All right? I'm not your teddy bear. Anyways, guys. First of all, DJ Scratch is hanging out with us today.
Guest interviewer today.
But he's not.
I never understand like why we have to do this intro. They pressed on a computer screen where it says who's here.
But see, you're right every time you say that, except for today, because Scratch isn't our guest today.
But are you not going to write his name on the description?
He'll get a featuring. He gets a featuring. But this isn't the DJ Scratch episode.
Featuring.
Because right now, it sort of is the Scratch episode because the man credited with the Scratch, Grand Wizard Theodore, is here.
Yes.
Welcome.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you.
It's an honor for us to have you here.
Honor's all mine. I'm so happy to be here, man. So happy.
Have you
to
ever
be
met
here.
Him before?
I don't think so. Have we ever met before?
No.
I don't think so.
Before. No. No.
Have you? Are you?
I don't think.
But meeting him, I feel like I've known him for a long time. I mean, I've watched him. I've listened to him. I've watched the Hollywood Squares.
That's nice.
Wishing I was on the middle box and stuff like that.
Listen, if it was mine, if it was my show, trust me, you would have had the center square.
That was a good show.
Yeah, I loved it, man.
Oh, thank you.
And
we are expecting Jazzy J, who's not here yet, and we're celebrating the anniversary of Zulu Nation, which goes down this weekend.
Yes, sir.
Over the course of 3 days, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Well, do you know what the exact details of the events?
No.
But it's Friday, Saturday, and Sunday?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Where's the place where people can find all of this information?
Well, you can find it on, you can just go to ZuluNation.com, and you can go to Zulu Nation on Facebook, and you can find everything that's needed to be, you know, found and stuff like that.
I'm pulling it up. I'm going to pull up the information right now on the Zulu Nation anniversary. Every year, the anniversary is a very cool event. I've had the privilege of participating a few times, and it's a great time. This year, I'm actually off this weekend, so I'm going to try to actually just come through. Scratch, you're doing something, aren't you?
Yes, sir.
What are you doing?
I'm DJing on Friday at the Harlem. I don't know. I can't remember the name of the actual venue. We're not but doing it's right there.
It's a Miss 46.
116th Street?
Yes, sir. Between Lenox and 5th.
Oh, yeah. Perfect.
Yeah. I might do 45s, actually.
How are you not going to do 45?
I rarely do, but.
You rarely do?
Yeah, but you know what? Events like this, where I know it's going to be a bunch of DJs there, I just want to do something different, so I'll probably bring some vinyl.
Syph, before we get to Grand Wizard Theodore and his story, what are your, while we're talking about Zulu Nation, your early recollections of when you first heard about and had any interaction with Zulu Nation?
Not much. I mean, Afrika Bambaataa, obviously, and the records he put out.
Q-Tip going, Zulu Nation!
Yeah, like Tribe, really, like.
Jungle Brothers and Tribe?
Jungle Brothers, I started to like after Tribe.
So, me too, actually.
So Tribe, hearing remnants of it. Because most rappers I know in those days were saying a lot of 5% stuff. And Q-Tip was saying like Zulu Nation stuff. So I was like, oh, this must be something different.
And how, you know, obviously Jazzy J, who's founding, would you say he's a founding father of Zulu Nation? I mean, Afrika Bambaataa we know is the founding father.
Right.
But do you have an official relationship with Zulu Nation? Have you always just been in? What's your relationship, Theodore?
Oh yeah, definitely. I felt I was a Zulu Nation from the day I was born, because all the teachings and all the practices that the Zulu Nation teach everyone, no matter what color you are, I practice that every day. You know, I drink a lot of water. I eat a lot of steamed vegetables.
Syph, this is like you are Syph. You are now Zulu Nation.
You know, I try to learn about all the different ethnic people. Like when I go to Japan, I try to learn about their culture. If I go to Brazil, if I go to different parts of the world, I want to learn about, you know, their culture. I want them to learn about my culture and stuff like that. And, you know, what makes Zulu Nation so unique is that, you know, they teach you about your ancestors, no matter what color you are. You know, it's good to learn about your ancestors. It's good to eat the right foods. It's good to respect your elders. It's good to go to school and learn, you know, learn stuff so that you can be, you know, you can have a contribution to the world, you know?
Let's talk a little bit about your story, Theodore. You were born in South Carolina. Is that correct?
Well, I was actually born in Harlem Hospital, hospital that DMC was born in.
Wow.
Shout out to DMC from Run DMC. And I was born, I was raised in the Bronx.
Why did it say online that you moved to South Carolina? Is that an existent thing, or that's?
Well, my family is from, you know, South Carolina, Lower South Carolina, you know, Greensboro and stuff like that, you know. And, you know, one of the things about, you know, us pioneers still being here, we have to make sure that we teach everybody and make sure that everybody learn the right information about
Absolutely.
Us. And that's another reason why we have the Hip Hop Museum coming out. And the Hip Hop Museum is going to be coming out, and we're going to make sure that everybody, my kids, your kids, our grandkids, and so on and so forth, can know about all the pioneers and the contributions that they made to this art form, this culture we call hip hop, past, present, and future.
So how did the music thing start for you, Theodore?
Well, the music started for me through my brother Mean Gene and Grandmaster Flash. That's how I got introduced to the whole, you know, hip hop culture, the whole hip hop art form and stuff like that. When I see my brother Mean Gene and Grandmaster Flash with two turntables and a mixer, right then and there, that's what I knew what I wanted to do.
To the degree that you are credited with inventing the scratch, how talk about that.
Well, I created two styles of DJing, which is the needle drop and the scratch.
Were you there with me the day I was watching the needle drops?
No.
On YouTube?
Yeah, no.
It is the most bonkers thing I've ever watched. Theodore, I was practicing last night. Wow. And I've gotten within like a couple of bars of getting it right.
Wow.
So okay, start with that. So that was just something you started messing with. And for people who don't know what that means, the needle drop is literally lifting up the needle and dropping it on the record as if almost you have two copies of the record, because you're bringing it back to the same exact spot.
Yes.
My favorite thing to do.
Just have one record?
One or two. It's my favorite thing to do.
And you're just catching it on the right spot?
Yeah. I put a couple of videos up on Instagram of doing it.
How are you doing it?
Very natural the way he does it.
You see where to put it?
You know, like, let's say there's a break and you just pick the needle up. Let's say you're doing it with two turntables. You leave the fader in the middle.
Right.
And you just pick the needle up, drop it on the break, go to the next one, drop it on the break, on beat.
No headphones.
No headphones. No fader use.
Right.
Leave the fader in the middle. Both turntables on. Pick the needle up. Drop it. Pick the needle up. Drop
crazy.
It. I show you a video.
Oh my God. Yeah. So you just started messing around.
Well, what I did was, my mother had like one of those big long coffins. You know, it's a big long coffin, and in the front is a television, and when you lift the coffin up, the turntable is inside.
Component wow. set.
Yeah, yeah. So I used to play her 45s, and when it got to the break part of the 45, which is the darkest part of the record,
yeah.
I used to lift the needle up back to the beginning of the break, and not knowing that the many times as I did it, the longer times I do it, I was developing the needle drop style. So when I got on the big turntables, the needle drop style was like, it was already there. You know?
How long did it take you to get to the point, or do you not even remember because you just did it naturally, where you could do it seamlessly and always hit the same spot? Because for anyone out here who's listening, who is not even a DJ but simply has a turntable or has messed around, getting any spot with a record, with a needle, is very difficult. It takes really having a knowledge of records and how to be comfortable holding a needle to even do that.
Right, right.
So did it just happen over time that you started getting really good at dropping the right
spot? Yeah, over time, because I have no idea what I was doing. I was just... Only thing I was worried about and concentrating on was getting the needle back to the beginning of the break, because it sounded so good to me, not knowing that as time went by and the more I matured as a person, you know, it just came so natural. And then it got to the point where I started to count, because you have to count too. It's like the bars, 1, 2, 3, 4, one bar, 1, 2, 3, 4, two bars. So I will count the record, and then I will watch the record go around in a 360, knowing that if you have a record that says Sly and the Family Stones, and you know that the break comes in at the word Sly, when you pick the needle up and to Sly, it comes right back to the break part. So when you watch the record go around, when you start counting, and when you lift the needle up just at the right time, it all coincides with each other. And that's how I created the
How do you think
drop.
You would do it this life? Just checking it out.
No, I think if you would be taught the fundamentals, like I just explained, you know,
yeah,
counting
I'm
the
sure
record.
Yeah, I'm sure I could figure it out if it takes sure a lot of practice or feeling.
Yeah, that's how I taught myself on my mother's component set. Same way, actually, and with Dancing Drummers Beat, when that first came out.
Yeah, that's the one to do it.
In 1978, the Electric Cat version with the whistle.
Oh yes. Oh my god.
And I would just pick the needle up and keep dropping it on that break, because that was just the fun part of the record. And I would just do that, drop it. It wasn't the record wasn't on beat, but I would always catch it at the beginning of the break. And by the time I got to real turntables, that was just natural to do.
So what about the scratching thing, Theodore? This is I don't know if you know, this is sort of a big deal.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm just very happy to be a part of something that's bigger than I am, and to be able to say that my contribution to this art form, to this culture, you know, basically help, you know, change the world as we all know it. Now, my last year of junior high school, my principal played music through the loudspeakers in the lunchroom, and people got tired of listening to that crazy, you know, Van McCoy music he was playing, Donna Summer and stuff he was playing. So a friend of mine's, you know, he convinced my principal to let me make a cassette tape. So what I did was I went home to make a cassette tape. And back in the early days, in order for us to make a cassette tape, we had to take a big boom box and put it in front of the speaker and press record. I mean, sometimes when we do block parties, you see guys with a boom box standing in front of the bass speaker for like an hour. You know, you got 45 minutes on each side, so like 90 minutes standing in front of the bass speaker. And then once the cassette is finished, they go in the corner and press play, and all they hear is because the speaker is
they recorded the wrong speaker.
There were no input output jacks on boom boxes back then.
Yeah, so they basically got the boom box in the bass instead of having it
right,
in
but
the
you don't
tweeters.
Want, yeah, for recording, you don't want, that's not going to work out.
Yeah.
Just love, what amazes me about this is that the culture as we know it wouldn't exist if there weren't people who were willing to take that kind of care. Like, no, I know the party's going on, but I'm going to record. Because that's really so much of the things that you guys all learned to do, and then we all ended up learning through different iterations later, is because people were willing to do that. If it had been me and Saif who started the culture, we would have just went to sleep. We would have just left. It was too difficult. This is a pain. I got to hold the stereo the whole time. But you did skirt the question, Theodore.
Yes, sir.
As you sit next to DJ Scratch, mm-hmm. Do you credit yourself as inventing the scratch?
Yes.
So you finish the story, junior high school.
Take us back to junior high school. Sorry, I got
no,
scared.
Yes.
And then I started making the cassette.
Okay.
And the music that I was practicing on is in my mother's house. And I got the kind of mother where she doesn't argue, she doesn't raise her voice, she just starts swinging like Mike Tyson. That's where my mom's is. She come home, dishes not done, she starts swinging.
Where's she from? What's your ethnic background?
She's from the Carolinas.
Okay. And American? I mean, where are they from before that? You from the islands?
An African living in America.
Okay, African.
Okay. Right. As we call it. And, you know, it's like, when she bust in the room, I was playing music, I was playing a record, and back then, our mixers, crossfaders didn't go from left to right. Our crossfaders went up and down. So when moms came and bust in the room, both my crossfaders went up because she kind of startled me because I had one record going off and one record I needed to blend in. So when she startled me, both crossfaders went up in the air, which means that I could hear both records at the same time. So what I did was I did a baby scratch. Pulled the music down a little bit. She left the room, played the next record, finished my cassette tape, and when I rewind it back to the part where my mother came in the room, I can hear myself baby scratching. I was like, wow, I can incorporate that into all the other things that I do as a DJ. So I practiced it another couple of days, another couple of hours, different records, and that's when it became the scratch. I was 12 years old in 1975,
shit.
Which makes me... What, 22 years old?
22 years old. You are 22.
Yeah.
So, I mean.
But other people must have been doing it in their headphones, right? Or getting the record ready. Like, but no one put the fader up to hear it.
Right, yeah. Like, had you ever done it before while you were doing, like, while you were cueing a record but didn't realize it was something that could sound good?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely
like,
so, right.
Like, even DJs before right. hip-hop, when you worked at a radio station and the way you played music was
pulling
vinyl,
the record
somebody
back.
Somebody had to pull it back with their hand, but right. It probably sounded wrong.
Right.
Like, oh, that
you happened to get one.
You had right. the fader up.
You're absolutely right.
And then you heard it and was like, that shit sounds kind of right.
Yeah. So what?
You know,
so
but
what?
You know, back
what
we, then it was a lot of it was a lot of rules as far as DJing. Like mm-hmm. you weren't supposed to put your fingers on the record. That right. was a rule.
On the side, right?
And you're supposed to grab the side.
Right.
Like if you ever see any footage from the early 80s,
they're all
70s,
on the top of them.
They're like this.
Yeah.
And then these guys, they just broke the rules and put their fingers on the record.
Right.
You know, and that just changed the game.
It's so funny, by the way, that people thought that like touching the record was so bad.
It was bad.
It is.
But why? It's
it
not
still
really
is.
That, it's not it's that bad.
Bad.
Well,
it,
one
is.
Of the reasons why
if you
it's
clean
bad.
Your records, you can touch the record. It's not going to destroy the groove. There are things we do that are worse.
The needles weren't as good back then.
Right,
the turntables
right.
were floppy back then. Any dust or
yes, oil or, on your hands.
Yeah, like
all that
oil
you know?
On the dust. Like, we know how to master it now, plus the vinyl's way better now, or, like, not now, but, you
the
know.
Needles are made better now yeah. for scratching. It.
Right.
Especially so, back in the days with us, it's like, you know, your parents, you know, were having dinner, and you got potato salad on your hands and barbecue sauce, and you want to put it on the record. That was
no,
like a no-no.
Yeah, of course.
It was a no-no.
Back then, the needles, if you pulled the record back, probably the needle would probably fucking snap backwards. Like
The needles were more actually... sharper like they
and more damaging to the record
yeah,
right so
yeah.
so okay what what turntable did this happen on
some I had a Technique I think it was a Technique 2300 I think it was
it belt
it was yes it was belt drive
it's a belt
yes.
drive
but who's you were 12 whose turntable was it your brother's or
yeah it was my brother's turntables yeah
did he have a set
yeah
you had a set yeah because you said yeah. you had the mixer so at that point what was considered a DJ mixer was just a smaller, not a huge mixing board, a smaller board with only vertical levers.
Yes.
And you would just pot up and down and that's it.
Yes.
Because this is all pre the single pull double throw
Absolutely.
Switch.
Yes.
So at this point, so you start practicing the scratch. When did you first break it out and someone else saw it and was like, what are you doing?
Well, we used to do... Back in the early days, and a lot of DJs, when the summertime came, that was time for the DJ to do as many block parties as he possibly can so that when it gets wintertime and we go to school and start handing out flyers, everybody will remember us from the block parties. Okay, these guys used to do block parties. They play good music. They got a nice little sound system. Okay, let's go and let's go to their, you know, let's go to their party on the inside. And when I first did the Scratch in the Park, it basically electrified the crowd because it's like hearing your favorite record and hearing me interject certain parts of the record, and the B-boys went crazy. Everybody in the party started, you know, coming up to the front of the turntables, wondering why I'm cutting up Rick James and Evelyn Champagne King and Dennis Coffey Breaks and stuff like that, and trying to figure out how is this little kid, like, you know, keep interjecting certain parts and scratching certain parts of the record. It just basically electrified everybody, you know. And that's the more time went by, it was the more time that my skills kept getting better and better and better as a DJ.
But
you know,
but other people were playing parts of records, right? Like breaks, but they were like mixing them in.
Well,
like why was the like you actually like the noise, like the
yes.
So how were people doing?
Foreign to people at the time.
Yeah, definitely.
So what was so people were just simply before that dragging the record back and then starting it.
Exactly.
Without letting you hear the drag back.
Exactly.
You would simply
yes.
hear, they'd bring it down, mm-hmm. they'd bring down, if they're on the left turntable, they would bring down the right pot, they would cue back to the spot, mm-hmm. then they would release it, lift up the right pot, and let exactly. that record go and pull down the left one.
So
right.
you were good, like who was, like Flash was obviously good back then.
Yes.
It would be on beat.
Yes.
Like he would keep bringing the beat, the break on beat.
Exactly, yes.
And then you added the
right. Yeah.
Back then, that first scratch had, how bad was your first scratch? The early scratches, because even early scratches on records in rap are terrible when you go back and listen to them to where it came. Yes. I mean, God bless. I'm not going to name names of some of our famed pioneers. That's a whole other thing. Scratch, honestly, pre you, like your era is when it started to change that the scratches became, I mean, so what you're saying, which is arguably
groundbreaking.
I mean, so what you're saying, arguably, Syph, would you say arguably one of the best scratch moments of all time?
Yeah.
On a chorus.
I mean, definitely sets it off.
Like that before that, you know, you listen to some, you're like, what were we even doing?
I mean, I have to admit, like, my baby scratches were a little sloppy and stuff like that, but as time went on, I felt my scratches get a little bit more tighter, you know, because my mentality was like, if I want to get noticed, I have to do something different.
Yeah.
I have to be different from all the other DJs, you know? And me and Flash was basically the only DJ. Like, Flash came up with extending breaks and stuff like that. If a break is 10 seconds long, Flash would make it 3-4 minutes long. He created a theory called the backspin where, you know, he would get the break and then the break would go and the record would revolve like 2-3 times in the 360 and he would like pull the record back 2-3 times and get it back to the break and stuff like that. So, you know, Flash and I was basically, our skills were so advanced to where DJs were chasing us. And
what were other DJs doing though? Just playing songs?
Yeah, just playing songs. It's like listening to a song and everybody's dancing and then when they switch the record you have to stop dancing and then catch the beat again. So
they weren't doing it on beat, really.
No, they was not doing it on
songs.
Beat. Yeah. So it was like,
and nobody, I mean, were people mad? That's just the way it was back then.
It was a little frustrating. You know, you on the floor, you dance with your
girl
you dance with the, you know, you dance with a pretty girl and all of a sudden the record changed and it skips a beat and you have to stop. And then you have to catch on beat.
But it was
kind of
normal, though.
Yeah, it was normal. Yes, it was normal.
And then when Flash and you and all the dudes started catching it on beat, it was like, oh, this shit is, we haven't stopped yet.
Right. You don't know when the record, you don't know when the record switched.
With that break,
you know?
Part. Like,
that's when the BPMs came into play and stuff like that. And, you know, because you could be playing Van McCoy, which is probably like 120 beats per minute,
mm-hmm.
and then you will switch into
a James Brown,
which is like 90s.
People like, but it's a good song though.
Yeah, people like look at you like, wow, are you? What are you drinking? Fuki Plum, or you know, Boonsbury Farm, or you know?
Syph, what's Fuki Plum?
I'm not sure.
It's like a wine.
Okay.
Like what I remember as a child, like I seen two types of DJs. Like when I was a child, like I'm from Brooklyn, so Grandmaster Flowers, he was like one of the best DJs like he was a disco DJ. So he would blend songs neatly because to keep the party going. But then I also noticed when the style of DJs changed as far as the breaks are concerned, with finding different breaks, a DJ would just bring the record over. There was no real cueing. So it would be offbeat. So if you can't, so if you got one record playing, the next record's coming on. There was really no cueing at the time. So it would just be offbeat. And that it was
okay.
How did
the disco DJs do it then, though?
The disco DJs, they would just count. You know what I mean? Like if you remember, most disco records were the same tempo.
Yeah, they're all around the same. So that certainly helps.
It wasn't hard to keep the beat going.
So yeah, I guess, I mean, we look at like hip hop and DJing as the beginning, but there was people spinning records on turntables
records
way
from
before
the beginning of time.
Like, some of those blends
Studio
were probably
is not a hip hop club. No. But somebody was in there mixing records
with two turntables always, right?
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
See, that's interesting.
So what were they like? I mean, I guess turntables were around.
Of course.
Yeah, they had turntables. They was using the knob mixes, the Bozak mixer, the Yuri.
Have you ever looked into when people first started having two turntables in general?
No, but I've seen pictures from like the 40s where DJs had two turntables.
Right.
Yep. Like
all the way back
to
the 40s.
That has to be.
And then you had like
else would it be?
You wait.
You stop.
you stop and wait.
But just like with anything, you know what I mean? Like for example, skateboarding. Like I used to skateboard when I was a kid, and I used to know how to go up on the ramp. Do you remember the first skateboard that came out that had two ramps?
Yeah.
A ramp on each end. It was the sky blue one.
Yes, I remember that. Yes.
When that skateboard came out in the 70s, I learned how to, you know, I don't know what they call it, but just go back and forth on each end. But now look what they're doing on skateboards.
Yeah, boy.
So it's like, yeah, you know, we had the same thing. It's just people took their imagination further and just took it to a whole nother level. Yep. That's what happened with the DJing.
There was good DJs. What were in the disco era before hip hop? Were there DJs mixing on the radio?
Yeah,
that they'd have two turntables up on the radio as well.
Yeah,
yes.
Disco records or soul records or whatever.
Yeah, like if you listen, just like New York radio, like 92KTU, 98.7 Kiss back then.
Who were the DJs on the radio then who played disco records?
Ken Skiders, not. Ken Spiderweb. Spiderweb was a host. I can't remember the DJs' names back then because back then it wasn't about the DJ.
It was about the host.
It was about the host.
It's a good era. I want that era back.
Yeah.
just like in the just like in the 80s and early 90s of hip hop.
MC.
You didn't know anybody. You didn't know a CEO of a label. You didn't know A&R. You only knew the artists.
Yeah.
Now you know the CEO and the A&R more than the artist. They're doing more interviews and
things have definitely changed. Yeah.
Theodore, who was the first other person that you heard scratch and you're like, ooh, that was what I was doing, but this guy's doing it even better?
Well, like past or present?
Yeah,
or,
like back then.
After you did it.
Maybe you did it when you were 12 and then you're 15, you were sitting there and you see Grandmaster Flash or someone else and you were like, damn, this guy's good.
Yeah, well, other DJs started to come into their own, like Chill Will and Barry B and stuff like that, you know?
Barry B.
Yeah, you know.
Was Barry B nice with it?
Beast. Yeah, he was. Yeah.
Really nice with it.
Then you had a Master Don from the Def Committee.
Beast.
And I was like, wow, something's about to happen here, you know? And then you had Scott LaRock and stuff like that. You know, God bless him. I think if Scott LaRock would still been alive now, it's no telling. He probably would have had his own record company, his own television station. He was definitely on to something, man. You know, God bless him, man.
And he was very young.
Yes, you know? And then you got DXT, you know, that you know, introduce scratching to the people in the world and stuff like that, you know?
How did he introduce it to the people of the world?
When he did the record Rocket with Herbie Hancock. And people got to see that on television. They was like, wow. I mean,
did you show up at his house and ask for a check?
he was like, man, nice to see him on TV. Like, he was like one of the first DJs I've seen on national TV.
Something's about to happen.
It was like he's up there with a band. Like, you never saw that. He was with a band, big production, stuff flying around. He got cordless headphones back then.
Whoa.
cordless headphones with the antenna up.
Yeah,
he got
the antenna, yeah.
He got the Michael Jackson Beat It jacket
what
on.
What show was this on?
Just YouTube it.
I mean, that's what I'm about to say. That's what I want to do. What Grammys, performance? It was the Grammys on there?
I think it was.
They but they got
the
footage of them just on tour.
Yeah, on tour.
Him on tour with Herbie Hancock. And,
yeah.
And he's scratching. He got the, for somehow he had the foot pedal, the wah-wah foot pedal hooked up to the turntables.
Yeah.
I don't know how he did that, but way before his time. Way before his time. But he was, just see him on TV like, yo, this dude is crazy.
Calzone, he had the Calzone cases for
the Calzone cases, yeah.
He was definitely ahead of his time, man. Yeah. Definitely ahead
he
of
from
his
the
time,
BX man. Also?
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, here it is. I just found, it didn't come up yet. It's a commercial.
It's really incredible.
But
man.
It's Rocket Herbie Hancock, 1983 Grammys.
Yeah, yeah. And when I seen it, I was like, you know, it's good that, you know, people are taking this art form to another level. It's just, you know, reassures me that it's going to be around for a long time, you know?
Joe sounds like.
Yeah, they should be incredible. On tour.
Yeah, yeah. It was definitely incredible. Definitely incredible.
So he introduced scratching to the mainstream.
Okay, hold on, guys. Sorry.
Yeah.
Why is there just a random, he has a random set of legs. Woohoo! There's DXT with the headphones, with the antenna.
Yeah,
wireless headphones.
Yeah.
Random set of legs just dancing on the stage. Y'all remember that?
Yeah. Very creative. Very creative. Oh, man.
What do you mean random set of legs?
You didn't see that?
When I first seen it, I was like, wow.
So those headphones really working though? Those
Yeah.
Yo, he's getting busy
it
on
worked.
The cuts, by the way.
Yeah. Worked.
Yeah. He was ahead of his time.
He had his own segment in the show. Like, it was crazy.
Yeah. He was definitely ahead of his time, man.
I want to give a shout out to Herbie. See? Random legs. I want to give a shout out to Herbie Hancock's drummer who performed at the Grammys and is literally wearing what looks like a t-shirt he wore to bed. That is amazing.
I got to relook at that again, because sometimes I get on YouTube or and just go searching for stuff like that. And, you know, I go and watch some DJ Scratch sometimes, you know.
Ah, my man.
And, you know, it's really amazing to see how far things has come, because I was there back at, you know, at the beginning, and to still be here and to see how things are now, man. It's like, it's surreal, man, to see how this art form, this culture has become, man.
Sife, do you want to see a video of Grand Wizard Theodore needle dropping blindfolded?
And this then KRS-One is freestyling.
Yeah, I think I've watched this one.
He did that on Scratch Vision, as a matter of fact.
The blindfold?
Yeah.
Wow.
Come on, bitch.
Yeah. Oh, here we go. Yo, this is insane.
It's like a double beat, man. And then he started to freestyle. Somebody called their mother and gave the phone to KRS-One, and he started freestyling. Yeah. I was like, wow, that is crazy. That is so crazy.
Do you feel, I often want to ask this to some of the pioneers, especially the DJs who didn't necessarily have their own records to make publishing off of and things like that. Do you feel that you've gotten your due, and you feel like you know, people have appreciated your contributions?
Well, I would say to that, I would say yes and no. I can't sit back and blame anybody for me not being where I want to be, or me being where I should have been and stuff like that. You know, I mean, right now I'm good. I ain't got to worry about how I'm going to pay my bills. You know, my condo's paid off, my house is paid off.
Is that all off of rap? All off of hip hop?
Yeah. I don't have to worry about how I'm going to pay my bills for the rest of my life and stuff like that.
Did that come mostly from gigging? Like mostly from just playing out all over the world?
You know, I've did the Wild Style movie. I've done the soundtrack to the Wild Style movie. I did the movie Scratch. You know, I'm still, you know, traveling around the world and stuff like that, you know. you know, I'm good.
So what are the regrets? You said that, though. First of all, two things. One, that makes me really happy to hear, because I never necessarily know exactly how people are doing. And I'm not going to lie, it comes with a certain level of, I have a certain level of, not guilt, because obviously I'm fine. I take my checks. But, you know, it is certainly weird for me, you know, and I thought about this when I first started here, especially being me, what I look like, where I come from. Mm-hmm. And there are pioneers who I know never were, not, believe me, I don't make what people were making 10 years ago to do my job, right. But I still make a good living in hip hop. So sometimes I feel a certain way about that.
Right.
So A, it's very nice to hear when a pioneer is doing well and has lived off of hip hop. But you said with a certain tone in your voice that you can't be mad at the places you didn't go. What would you have liked to do? Like, what could you have done more with what you were doing, do you feel?
I feel that I could have, like now, there's a lot of DJs that have like they own, you know, record deals and stuff like that. Like DJ, you know, Khalid, you know, and you know, he have his own deal. He's able to, you know, get artists and stuff like that.
Make the compilations. You
know? Yeah, compilations and stuff like that. I could have done that, but I decided to go a different route in my life and stuff like that. And you know, I've decided to like look a little bit more further into like real estate, like buy real estate and then sell it, and just trying to like cut a hole for me other than hip hop, because I said to myself, I'm not going to be doing this for the rest of my life. I want to be able to stand back and still be able to go to sleep and not DJ and still have my money working for me and stuff like
but
that.
In all fairness, there was no way for you to know that you could have essentially just done it forever.
Right.
You were being smart.
It wasn't a business.
It wasn't a business.
It was just doing it to have fun. It wasn't a business. So everybody from the first era of hip hop basically got jerked because it wasn't a business.
Right.
Exactly.
And it's not even really anyone.
We think of it now.
Right.
Like everybody gets into music already knowing it's a business, kind of.
Yes. But the crazy thing now is, like, even now, there's still people that are in the industry right now that don't know the business. Mm. And I never feel sorry for them because the information is out there. It's been out there for 20 years now.
Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, at this point, you don't have a good excuse.
For 20 years, all of the information that you need to know is out there.
Yeah. Right.
So there's no excuse.
Anybody who signs away their publishing, you're a fucking idiot.
Exactly.
Because we've heard so many stories of niggas getting jerked for their publishing.
You hear it for
years.
There's
no way you should sign that anymore. How are you not listening to every other horror story?
Exactly. And then they show movies. You got the rape movie where
they got books. You know, they got everything,
where, you know. And then you got the Frankie Lyman movie and stuff like that. There's a lot of movies out and stuff like that. But we did it for the love.
Yeah.
You know, but as we started to get older, people started to get kids, people started having mortgages, people started having car payments. That's when it got to the point where we had to say, do we want to keep doing this or do we want to go get a regular job?
Did you ever have a regular job? Like when you first was starting out?
Yes, I had a regular job. Yes, I got to the point.
You would have a job in the day and then do parties at night?
Yes. And then it got
How many parties were there back then? Like, let's say you're 18 or whatever.
Right.
How many parties were there? Just the weekends, or?
Well, we would end up doing parties on a Wednesday night, on a Thursday night, and then we would end up doing a party on a Friday and Saturday night. It all depends upon how you wanted to get out there. If you wanted to do Wednesday and Thursday night, you had to get out there and get the venue, get the flyers done, call the graffiti artists, get the flyers done. Yeah. You had to go out there and work for it.
Yeah.
And you can have a jump on the other people that just want to party on Friday, other DJs that want to party on just Friday and Saturday.
Right.
If you start doing parties on Wednesdays and Thursdays, then you have a better jump on people because you start to get into people that's 25 to 30 years old that's partying that can afford to party on a Wednesday or on Thursday. And then when you get to Friday and Saturday, then you're mostly partying with the teenagers and stuff like that. So, you know,
it's still, to this day, you could find a party on a weeknight where
especially in New York,
especially in New York.
Like, I always had a question that I never asked you when I interviewed you back then when y'all were killing it with the Grand Wizard Theater on the Fantastic Romantic Five. How did y'all split that money up?
Wow.
You know, this is before records were made, so they was just, you know, performances.
Just gigs.
There was no records being made right back then.
And there's five of you.
How did y'all splitting that money up?
Yeah. Well, what I did was, being that I was, you know, the head of the group, what I did was we used to, it got to the point where I say, it's six of us. So I had to make sure that we had like 3-4 parties a week. We were partying on a Saturday, we were partying on a Friday, and I was getting gigs like at Danceteria and The Grill and stuff like that on a Wednesday and Thursday night. We were coming downtown and playing for the punk rockers and getting like $600-$700, and I was able to split that between us. And then we probably end up doing a party at 1018. And then I'll probably be able to split that money with the five. And then
when
Fridays,
y'all battle.
Yeah, when we battle, yeah. And I'm splitting that money with them too. Money. So,
well, how was the battle money? How'd that work?
Battles, man.
Yeah, it's like
I still got my tapes.
It's like if me and you Rosenberg
battle
Cypher and Scratch.
Terrible matchup already. I see major matchup problems.
and the purse is $1,000. We will all probably get in the room and say, listen, how about we do $700 to the winner and $300 to the loser? Mm. And we'll probably say, nah, winner take all, you know? So if it's like winner take all, me and you probably end up losing to these two guys. And we go home with no money and they will go home with the whole $1,000. So,
but you might cut a deal. Someone might be like, all right, let's split it. Let's just all do our best, but that way everyone makes some money.
When that Saturday night special come out.
Yeah, because we were all from the inner city. We were all having the same struggles. We were all living with our parents. You know, we were all, you know, everybody was going through the same struggles. So we figure, you know, $700 to the winner and $300 to the loser. And it got to the point where we was like, you know, we did it with Cold Crush. Be like, look, Cold Crush, why don't we just give you, you know, whoever loses, take the $700. Whoever win, you know, they was like, nah, man, win and take all. Okay, cool. You know, so
it is what it is.
Fantastic Five. We was end up winning all the money.
Okay,
that was a legendary battle. Oh man. Yeah.
What, Cold Crush versus Fantastic Five?
Yeah.
How, okay, now, Cypher. Yeah. I'm sorry. Jump in here if you know more than I do. I know that this is both a gap for both of us. So how did these battles even work? What does the actual battle consist of?
Well, the battle consists of just basically both crews just getting up there and doing their thing. The owner of the venue probably said, okay, each group got 15 minutes. Coach Cross get up there, they do their 15 minutes. Fantastic Five get up there and do their 15 minutes. And at the end of the party, we get both crews on the stage and the people in the crowd.
So was it about rocking the party for that 15 minutes, though?
Yes.
About the MC with the routines.
Yes. And the routines. Yes.
And we let the crowd judge. So you can't really say, okay, well, it was fixed.
What was happening
and stuff
before
like
that? Just music was being played, like a club?
So it would be a party most of the night, and then you have the battle?
Right.
Specifically?
Exactly, yes.
And now, who was MC for your crew?
I had the Fantastic Five was all.
So they were all, you were the only DJ?
Yes, the only DJ.
And the Fantastic Five were all MCs?
Were all MCs,
and they would switch off?
Right. We would do dance routines. I would switch the record, do a dance routine, switch the record. Each one of them do their little individual rap, and then we would do the group rap, the dances. It was the whole 15 minutes was just routines. As if they were the Jackson 5. Everybody would do routines, dance steps, harmonizing.
You would
everything.
Come up with new ones
yes.
all the time.
Yes.
I'm embarrassed to ask this question in front of DJ Scratch, but I learned from Cypher Sounds, not intentionally. You didn't teach me this as a lesson. I've just told you this is a trait that I like of yours. If you don't know something, just ask.
Right.
Who was DJing for Cold Crush?
DJ Charlie Chase. And
Charlie Tone.
Charlie Chase and Tony Tone were DJing for Cold Crush.
Yes.
Right.
And did they get the best of you more often than not, or was it usually even? Scratch, I'll go to you. You have the tapes.
Well, I just listen. Well, when the tapes, it was all about the MCs. The DJ would just keep the beat going.
Yep, exactly.
So you're just looping. You're basically just looping and
just playing records. And
were you scratching a little bit too?
Yeah, I'm scratching a little.
Okay.
Yeah.
The tapes is there. Like one of my favorite. With Theodore and the Grand, actually, I don't even think this tape was the all of the Fantastic Five, because some of y'all would just mix and match sometime.
Yeah.
Like it'd be like Melly Mel on the mic while Theodore's DJing. You know what I mean? Like, but the tape where you were cutting up 2001.
Mm. Wow.
Space Odyssey.
Not Space Odyssey. It was 2001. can't remember the complete title. Buddha Records. Yeah, on that soundtrack.
Yeah, soundtrack, yeah.
And he go, before you go, you must know the man on the mix is the one-man show. He wasn't a DJ before, but he came back for more, giving you cuss galore. Goes by the name of the Grand Wizard Theodore, that joint.
You got a good memory, huh?
Yeah, that joint. Crazy.
How do you... That's one thing I have to say. It's an area of rap history that I'm interested in, but I've never braved before because it's before my time and my knowledge base is so low. But Scratch, where did you trade tapes? I'm talking about past childhood. I know when you were a kid, you'd get them. But in the last 20 years, are there other people who have great tape collections who you exchange with?
No, I don't exchange with anybody.
Do you dub for people? Do people copy, or you just hold on to
your own? I got them all. I got everything that was available. I have it.
Because
like I said, I'm from Brooklyn, and you know, the older cats that were able to go uptown, because Brooklyn went everywhere. You know what I'm saying?
Still.
Why? Right. Why are they like that?
Back then, you wouldn't catch Bronx cats in Brooklyn or Queens cats in Brooklyn unless it was a gig. You know what I mean? But Brooklyn went everywhere, and the older cats from my hood would go to the Fever, go to the T Connection, and record those jams and come back home.
Wait, and record them?
Yeah, that's how the tapes got out. That's how the tapes got out. Like, they'd be there with their boombox.
How shitty is the quality of most of these tapes?
If you catch it from somebody who was there, the quality is great, but it gets dubbed like 100 times. You know what I mean?
So it gets worse and worse.
And then back then, there weren't double cassette decks back then. So you would have to put, so the double tape, you put two boomboxes in front of each other.
Yeah.
Just play on one, press record on the other.
Yeah.
This is a nightmare to even think about how bad
that's
the quality is.
That's how you would double tape back then.
So if you're standing on a stoop, you're in Brooklyn, you want to double tape on a stoop, and a car honks their horn, it's on there.
Oh, yeah. It's on there. Oh, man. That's how we used to dub tapes back then.
It's horrible.
That's crazy.
So did you... Did you have someone, an older kid in the neighborhood, who hooked you up with some of your stuff?
Yeah, like the older cats from my hood, they'd be up there, they come back with some gazelles, they go on to rob people. That's what they was doing.
Stop by and check out a show while you're out robbing people.
And if they're gonna go to the show because it was the shit. But if they see something they want, they're gonna bring it back home.
Brooklyn keeps on taking it.
That's right.
And they got the recording for the show as well. So if they can get the recording of the show and come back with a sheepskin.
Double bonus.
Yeah. Double bonus.
Theodore, did you care?
Exactly.
Wait, what was that?
Quarter fills. It was a
very stylish jacket with the dog
with
fur.
With the
dog
fur.
Of course.
corduroy coat. It was a corduroy coat.
With the fur on the collar.
The fur.
Oh, yeah. Very nice.
Theodore, did you, as you were in it, did you care about the tapes as well? Or did you not care? You were just showing up and performing?
Oh, no. The tapes were very, very important because.
Did you have someone recording for you? Would you have someone in the crowd?
Yes. We always had someone recording for us. And then there was this guy called Tape Master. He was a real big guy, and he recorded all of us. And after he recorded us, he ended up giving us a copy of the recordings and stuff like that. And it got to the point where he was the only person that had recordings of 90% of all the shows that was going on. So in order to get a cassette tape, you had to go to the guy called Tape Master.
Is he still around?
No. God bless him. He's not around no more. You know?
What happened to his collection?
That's a good question. I think that it just got passed around to different people. I think a lot of his collection got messed up and stuff like that because, you know, when you protect your stuff so much and then, God forbid, something happened to him, you don't know if one of his relatives got to it and destroyed.
It's like, this is why I have this conversation with Alexa every day.
About
the records.
A lot of stuff from back then, just with anything as far as vinyl and cassettes, you didn't think to cherish it back then because it was just, that's what was going on. You know what I mean? Like, you didn't know it would become to what it is now or what it was to become 20 years ago.
Yeah.
So you didn't really...
understand the value, of course.
You didn't understand the value.
You didn't know it was the level of history it would be.
But just me being a hoarder and
and nerd in general?
Being a hoarder and a student, I studied everything. I studied those tapes. That's what made me become a DJ. Like, I studied those tapes, so I always kept them because that's where my whole existence comes from. Everything. So I always kept them tapes.
And now people are collecting flyers.
Yes, flyers are big.
Oh my god.
Flyers are a thing. Do you have flyers?
Yeah, I have flyers. Yeah. It's people, they're going crazy for flyers. I find myself now making copies of flyers cuz I don't want to get rid of all my flyers. I'll make a copy for you.
Have you given some to like historical places?
Yes.
Like I know there's a couple universities out there that are trying to make, you know, cultivate these these things.
Cornell University. They
Cornell, of all schools, by the way, the whitest school on earth. I mean, it couldn't get any whiter. But they have this thing that they're putting
Shout
together.
Shout out to my dude Rich Medina. He's a Cornell graduate.
He is?
He's the one that actually.
Rich is the only black graduate from Cornell University.
Probably is, but he's the one that curated the whole Bambada Records.
Oh, that situation. That was very cool.
That was through Rich Medina.
Wow.
That Rich and Cornell?
Yeah.
Yeah, they what have his it? Whole collection now.
They bought Bam's collection.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah, they bought his
collection. And what does he do now? He has no collection?
He had to have kept some, right?
Oh, he got records.
Yeah, he kept a stash.
But he got so many records, like.
That he could sell a whole collection and have a collection.
He can sell 700 crates of records.
You know, so his records are in,
they're in Cornell.
Yeah, they're in Cornell.
In like a museum,
like the Smithsonian type shit.
By the way, we're gonna get him up here soon. He just recently also toured this summer
with Levis Collection. He's at Sutra tonight. He's DJing at Santos tonight.
Bambada's at Santos
tonight. Tony Touch, yeah.
Wow, they're doing a special one, not at Sutra, at Santos.
Oh, it's at Santos now.
Yeah.
Oh, he moved altogether?
Yes. Sutra's closed.
It's a wrap.
Yeah.
It's quiet for Sutra.
Condos.
Yeah, she sold it.
No, really. Oh, I had some good memories there.
And Santos is more bigger.
Yeah, no, it's a more, better.
Oh, my God. Bigger. I played at Santos a couple weeks ago.
What happened?
I was shook. Didn't want to do it. I was nervous.
Why?
Because I don't.
With Toka?
Those records are not in order. They're not like my. If I do a party now, my crates are in and my computer are in order.
Right.
I know. Believe me, I know.
My 90s is all over the place.
Oh, okay.
I had a fucking ball.
Just playing records?
I was dead, too. It was raining. It was only like 50 people, maybe.
Right.
Yo, I had a ball. You couldn't take me off the turntable.
Yo, what's it like staying up at night, man?
Mm. Oh, it's great.
It's fun?
He says
every night.
Being up at night? That sounds nice.
He says great.
I wish I could do. I did Tony Touch once. I had to like prepare mentally, sleep-wise, for like a month.
Wow.
Because it's a late party.
And morning show life is
impossible. Yeah. But one day, when I get fired, my return to the late night underground clubs is going to be immense.
I don't go out as much as I should. I've been doing a lot of comedy.
Yeah, you stay busy. Oh, wow. Okay. We got to let you guys go in a minute, but this weekend again, the great Zulu Nation celebrates their 41st anniversary.
Yes, sir.
I did an event last night real quick. I did this show at UCB. This guy does, it's called a variety hour, but every month he has this section where he does downtown history, and he's basically schooling New Yorkers who are not from New York about how the real New York is. It's a cool little funny segment.
Mm-hmm.
But some old lady that goes to his show asked him about hip-hop, so he brought me in as a hip-hop expert. And they had slides up and everything. Like,
They made the slides? You just
I told him what to use. I said, get Cool Herc, Grandmaster Theodore, Grandmaster Flash, pictures of the South Bronx, Afro Bambaataa, like, and they had all these slides up. And I just went, well, this is Cool Herc.
But were you being serious or tongue-in-cheek?
No, being serious.
It was all dead serious.
Yeah.
I heard an NPR feature on Kendrick Lamar. Well, I'm going to have to play a clip of it. Let me say something about white people. White people's whole lives revolves around what's on NPR. I have family who, like, it's like they don't even know that I do radio.
Oh, I met some lady from there.
Franny?
She never hit me back. I don't know.
Franny Kelly, who does the show with Ali Shahi Muhammad. All right, listen real quick. Listen to this for a second.
Let's focus now on an artist who is taking the hip-hop, and some could argue...
Like, how can you still say it that nerdy in 2014?
Hip-hop.
Let our colleague Steve Inske take it from here.
Here's a song with a title one letter long. It's the letter I. The artist is Kendrick Lamar. This is the world premiere. I've been through a whole lot. Tribulation, but I know God. I done been through a whole lot, he raps. Like many a rapper, he sings of himself. But there's something different about Kendrick Lamar.
It's just hilarious because, like, I really appreciate the coverage. I just can't believe it's still...
And I like that record.
Oh, the record's great.
I was like, wow. They flipped that Isley.
I know. It's pretty great. I heard like four Kendrick records yesterday. They play me.
Crazy.
And he's on some very Back to Africa, Black Righteousness stuff.
Nice.
But like up-tempo, can play in the club stuff. It's really good.
Yeah, he's spitting.
Theodore, where can people see you? You have any regular gigs? People can catch you needle dropping and doing things of that variety?
Well, when I'm here in town, I'm at the Scratch Academy. And I teach at the Scratch Academy, so I'm mostly there teaching my classes and stuff like that.
What
so
do you teach?
I teach the one-on-one classes, like when the students come in and want to learn scratching for the first time,
yeah.
I'm the one that they see when they first come in.
Who owns the Scratch Academy?
Rob Principi, Jam Master J, God bless him. They own the Scratch Academy.
And how big are the classes?
Very big. I can do a class and I can have like 50 students.
What?
I can have 30 students.
At once?
Yes, yeah. At once, yes.
There's that many sets? How many sets are there in there?
Yeah. 32, 31
How
sets?
Big is this place?
It's huge.
I want to do a guest lecture on what not to do.
A big round circle. There's about 30.
I might want to go check this out. Yo.
Yeah, I want to check out Scratch Academy.
Can we do something there?
Can you bring Camille and Saif come in and do a little talk or something?
Of course.
So you teach there like how
often? Or we could do a radio because we could talk about radio mixing.
I teach there like three, four times a month. 3-4 times a month.
Like, please. How often do people go to classes? Once a week?
Well, what happens is when you do the one-on-one classes, you have
one-on-one.
Yeah, one-on-one classes, and then you have 6 classes after that. So
different levels.
Yeah.
I thought you said 101, like the first.
Yeah, yeah, it is. Once you do the one-on-one class, then you able to do 6.
They have graduation and everything.
Exactly. Yeah.
There's Saif. There's levels to this shit. Hey.
Right.
We would love to come. I've always been very curious about that.
You know, that would be no problem.
Yeah. Now I want to ask you last thing. Scratch, you don't get to answer this because we're saving for your podcast. Some of your favorite DJs of all time that have made you proud. And I'm talking about all the way up to recent. Is there anyone who you just marvel at and think their skills are just, who come to mind?
Wow. Past, present, or future?
All.
Wow. One of the
Actually, if you could do future, that would be amazing. If you could tell us who down the road.
One of the person's skills that when I first seen him, I was like, oh my God, Rock Raider, God bless him.
Oh, yeah.
Rock Raider, God bless him. And then when I seen the Executioners and stuff like that, you know, and the Scratch Pickles and then DJ Q-Bert and stuff like that, you know. But when I seen Scratch, I was like, oh my God.
Man, Scratch, you know? He's all right.
I mean, the way he throws a record in the air and stuff like that. I remember the first time when I seen him do the Jason Mass, you know, on Friday the 13th. I'm going to play Jason.
That was you, Friday the 13th. I'm going to play Jason. Was you?
I was like, yes, what?
I remember. I had that DMC video, yeah.
Yo, when
classic.
I first seen it, I was like, wow, this is really being took into a next level. And I just feel happy that I'm still around to see this, man, because it's really incredible that all these DJs have taken this to another level, man. I'm just very happy, man.
That's great. I'm happy to hear that. Scratch, we will bring you in soon. Do you mind coming back in the next week, maybe?
Next
week. Why is he here?
We miscommunicated. I reached out to him first.
Yeah.
Then Eclipse set us up and was like, yo, we want to do some promo for Zulu Nation,
yeah.
Jazzy J and Theodore. So then I said, okay, because I hadn't heard back from Scratch confirmation.
Mm.
I thought he had not confirmed. He thought he had confirmed. And then he said, hey, I'm going to sit in anyway. And I said, that works out nice.
I'm happy.
Like Theodore and Jazzy J, I'm staying.
Yeah, listen, by the way, I want to shout out to everyone who listened to this all the way through. This was an episode for the real heads who wanted to hear the history of how this culture began. Jazzy Jeff.
Culture.
The culture of Kendrick Lamar. It's a song with one letter. Jazzy Jeff for me, guys, right at the top of my list. I got to say, I have recently been a big appreciator of A-Track.
Yeah, A-Track's dope, too.
A-Track's DMC tapes when he was, looks like a child.
Yeah, he looks a child.
I know, he's like 13 years. He was insane.
Yeah,
I know.
And
he got drunk after he won. We was all in London. I was like...
You remember, you knew A-Track as a little kid when he was young?
Yeah, I remember him, yes. I remember him, yes.
Hate all these
me,
people.
Him, me,
for
him.
For being talented.
And, DJ Craze, Jazzy Jeff, we all was on tour together. And the promoters was like, I mean, you guys like get along so well. I mean, he said I had a misconception that a lot of DJs don't get along. I said, hey, we get along. What can we possibly be fighting about? We all trying to accomplish the same thing. What are we
I got to tell
about?
You though, it is actually really funny. I generally get along with real DJs. I'm not talking about. I generally get along with real DJs better than just about anyone. They're always the people that I had the most to talk about with. Like even when I got to college, that's how I bonded with people. By the way, when I got to Maryland, when I showed up at WMUC in College Park, one of the first stories I heard about was DJ Scratch coming through with EPMD, and he did a set at WMUC. He doesn't even remember. He's got so many stories, he doesn't know. And he was DJing, and the actual table broke.
Ooh.
And he continued playing.
I remember.
And while the turntables were like slanted and falling down. You were part of lore at Maryland.
I remember that.
Hey, guys, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Not just thanks for coming. Thanks for everything.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Thanks for my life. Okay, good night.
Exactly.
Thank you.